Yeah, sure thing.
Hey, you sold that car yet?
Yeah, sold it to Carvana.
Oh, I thought you were selling to that guy.
The guy who wanted to pay me in foreign currency, no interest over 36 months? Yeah, no. Carvana gave me an offer in minutes, picked it up, and paid me on the spot. It was so convenient.
Just like that?
Yeah.
No hassle?
None.
That is super convenient.
Sell your car to Carvana and swap hassle for convenience. Pickup fees may apply.
Zaxby's just out Philly the Philly again. The Zaxby's Chicken Philly is back with garlic aioli, sautéed peppers and onions, decadent melty cheese, and your choice of Zaxby's signature crispy chicken fingers or delicious grilled chicken. But it's only back for a limited time, so enjoy it while you can. No pressure. It's just the greatest sandwich of all time on a ticking clock. Order the Chicken Philly today. Who's got the sauce? Zaxby's.
Chapter 52 of Barnaby Rudge, A Tale of the Riots of 80. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recorded by Mill Nicholson. Barnaby Rudge, A Tale of the Riots of 80 by Charles Dickens. Chapter 52. A mob is usually a creature of very mysterious existence, particularly in a large city. Where it comes from or whither it goes, few men can tell. Assembling and dispersing with equal suddenness, it is as difficult to follow to its various sources as the sea itself. Nor does the parallel stop here, for the ocean is not more fickle and uncertain, more terrible when roused, more unreasonable, or more cruel. The people who were boisterous at Westminster upon the Friday morning, and were eagerly bent upon the work of devastation in Duke Street and Warwick Street at night, were, in the mass, the same, allowing for the chance accessions of which any crowd is morally sure in a town where there must always be a large number of idle and profligate persons. One and the same mob was at both places. Yet they spread themselves in various directions when they dispersed in the afternoon, made no appointment for reassembling, had no definite purpose or design, and indeed, for anything they knew, were scattered beyond the hope of future union. At the Boot, which, as has been shown, was in a manner the headquarters of the rioters, there were not upon this Friday night a dozen people. Some slept in the stables and outhouses, some in the common room, some two or three in beds. The rest were in their usual homes or haunts. Perhaps not a score in all lay in the adjacent fields and lanes, and under haystacks, or near the warmth of brick kilns, who had not their accustomed place of rest beneath the open sky. As to the public ways within the town, they had their ordinary nightly occupants, and no others, the usual amount of vice and wretchedness, but no more. The experience of one evening, however, had taught the reckless leaders of disturbance that they had but to show themselves in the streets to be immediately surrounded by materials which they could only have kept together when their aid was not required, at great risk, expense, and trouble. Once possessed of this secret, they were as confident as if 20,000 men, devoted to their will, had been encamped about them, and assumed a confidence which could not have been surpassed, though that had really been the case. All day Saturday they remained quiet. On Sunday they rather studied how to keep their men within call, and in full hope, than to follow out by any fierce measure their first day's proceedings.
"I hope,"
said Dennis, as with a loud yawn he raised his body from a heap of straw on which he had been sleeping, and supporting his head upon his hand, appealed to Hugh on Sunday morning,
"that Muster Gashford allow some rest. Perhaps he'd have us at work again already, eh?"
"It's not his way to let matters drop, you may be sure of that," growled Hugh in answer. "I'm in no humour to stir yet, though. I'm as stiff as a dead body, and as full of ugly scratches as if I'd been fighting all day yesterday with wildcats."
"You've so much enthusiasm, that's it,"
said Dennis, looking with great admiration at the uncombed head, matted beard, and torn hands and face of the wild figure before him.
"You're such a devil of a fellow. You hurt yourselves 100 times more than you need, because you will be foremost in everything, and will do more than the rest."
"For the matter of that," returned Hugh, shaking back his ragged hair and glancing towards the door of the stable in which they lay, "there's one yonder as good as me. What did I tell you about him? Did I say he was worth a dozen when you doubted him?"
Mr. Dennis rolled lazily over upon his breast, and resting his chin upon his hand in imitation of the attitude in which Hugh lay, said, as he too looked towards the door,
"Aye, you knew him, brother, you knew him. But who'd suppose to look at that chap now that he could be the man he is? Isn't it a thousand cruel pities, brother, that instead of taking his natural rest and qualifying himself for further exertions in this here honourable cause, he should be playing at soldiers like a boy? And his cleanliness, too,"
said Mr. Dennis, who certainly had no reason to entertain a fellow feeling with anybody who was particular on that score.
"What weaknesses he's guilty of, with respect to his cleanliness. At 5 o'clock this morning, there he was at the pump, though anyone would think he had gone through enough, the day before yesterday, to be pretty fast asleep at that time. But no, when I woke for a minute or two, there he was at the pump, and if you'd seen him sticking them peacock's feathers into his hat when he'd done washing, I'm sorry he's such an imperfect character, but the best on us is incomplete in some point of view or another."
The subject of this dialogue, and of these concluding remarks, which were uttered in a tone of philosophical meditation, was, as the reader will have divined, no other than Barnaby, who, with his flag in hand, stood sentry in the little patch of sunlight at the distant door, or walked to and fro outside, singing softly to himself and keeping time to the music of some clear church bells. Whether he stood still, leaning with both hands on the flagstaff, or, bearing it upon his shoulder, paced slowly up and down, the careful arrangement of his poor dress and his erect and lofty bearing showed how high a sense he had of the great importance of his trust, and how happy and how proud it made him. To Hugh and his companion, who lay in a dark corner of the gloomy shed, he and the sunlight and the peaceful Sabbath sound to which he made response seemed like a bright picture framed by the door and set off by the stable's blackness. The whole formed such a contrast to themselves, as they lay wallowing like some obscene animals in their squalor and wickedness on the two heaps of straw, that for a few moments they looked on without speaking, and felt almost ashamed.
"Ah," said Hugh at length, carrying it off with a laugh, "he's a rare fellow is Barnaby, and could do more, with less rest, or meat or drink, than any of us. As to his soldiering, I put him on duty there." "Then there was a object in it, and a proper good un too, I'll be sworn,"
retorted Dennis with a broad grin and an oath of the same quality.
"What was it, brother?"
"Why, you see," said Hugh, crawling a little nearer to him, "that our noble captain yonder came in yesterday morning rather the worse for liquor, and was, like you and me, ditto last night."
Dennis looked to where Simon Tappertit lay coiled upon a truss of hay, snoring profoundly, and nodded.
"And our noble captain," continued Hugh with another laugh, "our noble captain and I have planned for tomorrow a roaring expedition with good profit in it."
"Again the Papists?"
asked Dennis, rubbing his hands.
"Aye, against the Papists. Against one of them, at least, that some of us, and I for one, owe a good heavy grudge to."
"Not Muster Gashford's friend that he spoke to us about in my house, eh?"
said Dennis, brimful of pleasant expectation.
"The same man," said Hugh.
"That's your sort,"
cried Mr. Dennis, gaily shaking hands with him.
"That's the kind of game. Let's have revenges and injuries and all that, and we shall get on twice as fast. Now you talk indeed." "The captain," added Hugh, "has thoughts of carrying off a woman in the bustle, and and so have I."
Mr. Dennis received this part of the scheme with a wry face, observing that as a general principle he objected to women altogether, as being unsafe and slippery persons, on whom there was no calculating with any certainty, and who were never in the same mind for 24 hours at a stretch. He might have expatiated on this suggestive theme at much greater length, but that it occurred to him to ask what connection existed between the proposed expedition and Barnaby's being posted at the stable door as sentry, to which Hugh cautiously replied in these words,
"Why, the people we meet to visit were friends of his once upon a time, and I know that much of him to feel pretty sure that if he thought we were going to do him any harm, he'd be no friend to our side, but would lend a ready hand to the other. So I've persuaded him, for I know him of old, that Lord George has picked him out to guard this place tomorrow while we're away, and that it's a great honour. And so he's on duty now, and as proud of it as if he was a general. What do you say to me for a careful man as well as a devil of a one?"
Mr. Dennis exhausted himself in compliments, and then added,
"But about the expedition itself?"
"About that," said Hugh, "you shall hear all particulars from me and the great captain conjointly and both together. For see, he's waking up. Rouse yourself, Lionheart. Put a good face upon it, and drink again. Another hair of the dog that bit you, Captain. Call for drink. There's enough of gold and silver cups and candlesticks buried underneath my bed," he added, rolling back the straw and pointing to where the ground was newly turned, "to pay for it, if it was a score of casks full. Drink, Captain."
Mr. Tappertit received these jovial promptings with a very bad grace, being much the worse, both in mind and body, for his 2 nights of debauch, and but indifferently able to stand upon his legs. With Hugh's assistance, however, he contrived to stagger to the pump, and having refreshed himself with an abundant draught of cold water, and a copious shower of the same refreshing liquid on his head and face, he ordered some rum and milk to be served, and upon that innocent beverage and some biscuits and cheese made a pretty hearty meal. That done, he disposed himself in an easy attitude on the ground beside his 2 companions, who were carousing after their own tastes, and proceeded to enlighten Mr. Dennis in reference to tomorrow's project. That their conversation was an interesting one was rendered manifest by its length, and by the close attention of all three. That it was not of an oppressively grave character, but was enlivened by various pleasantries arising out of the subject, was clear from their loud and frequent roars of laughter, which startled Barnaby on his post, and made him wonder at their levity. But he was not summoned to join them until they had eaten and drunk and slept and talked together for some hours, not, indeed, until the twilight, when they informed him that they were about to make a slight demonstration in the streets, just to keep the people's hands in, as it was Sunday night, and the public might otherwise be disappointed, and that he was free to accompany them if he would. Without the slightest preparation, saving that they carried clubs and wore the blue cockade, they sallied out into the streets, and, with no more settled design than that of doing as much mischief as they could, paraded them at random. Their numbers rapidly increasing, they soon divided into parties, and agreeing to meet by and by, in the fields near Welbeck Street, scoured the town in various directions. The largest body, and that which augmented with the greatest rapidity, was the one to which Hugh and Barnaby belonged. This took its way towards Moorfields, where there was a rich chapel, and in which neighbourhood several Catholic families were known to reside. Beginning with the private houses so occupied, they broke open the doors and windows, and while they destroyed the furniture, and left but the bare walls, made a sharp search for tools and engines of destruction, such as hammers, pokers, axes, saws, and such-like instruments. Many of the rioters made belts of cord, of handkerchiefs, or any material they found at hand, and wore these weapons as openly as pioneers upon a field day. There was not the least disguise or concealment. Indeed, on this night, very little excitement or hurry. From the chapels they tore down and took away the very altars, benches, pulpits, pews, and flooring, from the dwelling-houses the very wainscoting and stairs. This Sunday evening's recreation they pursued like mere workmen who had a certain task to do, and did it. 50 resolute men might have turned them at any moment. A single company of soldiers could have scattered them like dust. But no man interposed, no authority restrained them, and, except by the terrified persons who fled from their approach, they were as little heeded as if they were pursuing their lawful occupations with the utmost sobriety and good conduct. In the same manner they marched to the place of rendezvous agreed upon, made great fires in the fields, and reserving the most valuable of their spoils, burnt the rest. Priestly garments, images of saints, rich stuffs and ornaments, altar furniture, and household goods, were cast into the flames, and shed a glare on the whole country round. But they danced and howled and roared about these fires till they were tired, and were never for an instant checked. As the main body filed off from this scene of action, and passed down Welbeck Street, they came upon Gashford, who had been a witness of their proceedings, and was walking stealthily along the pavement. Keeping up with him, and yet not seeming to speak, Hugh muttered in his ear,
"Is this better, master?"
"No,"
said Gashford, "it is not." "What would you have?"
said Hugh.
"Thievers are never at their height at once. They must get on by degrees."
"I would have you,"
said Gashford, pinching his arm with such malevolence that his nails seemed to meet in the skin.
"I would have you put some meaning into your work. Fools! Can you make no better bonfires than of rags and scraps? Can you burn nothing whole?"
"A little patience, master," said Hugh. "Wait but a few hours, and you shall see. Look for a redness in the sky tomorrow night."
With that, he fell back into his place beside Barnaby, and when the secretary looked after him, both were lost in the crowd. End of chapter 52. Chapter 53 of Barnaby Rudge, A Tale of the Riots of 80. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recorded by Mill Nicholson. Barnaby Rudge, A Tale of the Riots of 80 by Charles Dickens. Chapter 53. The next day was ushered in by merry peals of bells, and by the firing of the tower guns. Flags were hoisted on many of the church steeples. The usual demonstrations were made in honour of the anniversary of the King's birthday, and every man went about his pleasure or business as if the city were in perfect order, and there were no half-smouldering embers in its secret places, which, on the approach of night, would kindle up again and scatter ruin and dismay abroad. The leaders of the riot, rendered still more daring by the success of last night and by the booty they had acquired, kept steadily together, and only thought of implicating the mass of their followers so deeply that no hope of pardon or reward might tempt them to betray their more notorious confederates into the hands of justice. Indeed, the sense of having gone too far to be forgiven held the timid together no less than the bold. Many who would readily have pointed out the foremost rioters and given evidence against them felt that escape by that means was hopeless, when their every act had been observed by scores of people who had taken no part in the disturbances, who had suffered in their persons, peace, or property by the outrages of the mob, who would be most willing witnesses, and whom the government would, no doubt, prefer to any king's evidence that might be offered. Many of this class had deserted their usual occupations on the Saturday morning. Some had been seen by their employers active in the tumult. Others knew they must be suspected, and that they would be discharged if they returned. Others had been desperate from the beginning, and comforted themselves with the homely proverb that, being hanged at all, they might as well be hanged for a sheep as a lamb. They all hoped and believed, in a greater or lesser degree, that the government they seemed to have paralysed would, in its terror, come to terms with them in the end, and suffer them to make their own conditions. The least sanguine among them reasoned with himself that, at the worst, they were too many to be all punished, and that he had as good a chance of escape as any other man. The great mass never reasoned or thought at all, but were stimulated by their own headlong passions, by poverty, by ignorance, by the love of mischief, and the hope of plunder. One other circumstance is worthy of remark, and that is, that from the moment of their first outbreak at Westminster, every symptom of order or preconcerted arrangement among them vanished. When they divided into parties and ran to different quarters of the town, it was on the spontaneous suggestion of the moment. Each party swelled as it went along, like rivers as they rolled towards the sea. New leaders sprang up as they were wanted, disappeared when the necessity was over, and reappeared at the next crisis. Each tumult took shape and form from the circumstances of the moment. Sober workmen, going home from their day's labour, were seen to cast down their baskets of tools and become rioters in an instant. Mere boys on errands did the like. In a word, a moral plague ran through the city. The noise and hurry and excitement had for hundreds and hundreds an attraction they had no firmness to resist. The contagion spread like a dread fever, an infectious madness, as yet not near its height, seized on new victims every hour, and society began to tremble at their ravings. It was between 2 and 3 o'clock in the afternoon when Gashford looked into the lair described in the last chapter, and seeing only Barnaby and Dennis there, inquired for Hugh. He was out, Barnaby told him, had gone out more than an hour ago, and had not yet returned.
"Dennis," said the smiling secretary in his smoothest voice, as he sat down cross-legged on a barrel. "Dennis!" The hangman struggled into a sitting posture directly, and with his eyes wide open, looked towards him. "How do you do, Dennis?" said Gashford, nodding. "I hope you have suffered no inconvenience from your late exertions, Dennis?"
"I always will say of you, Muster Gashford," returned the hangman, staring at him, that ere quiet way of yours might almost wake a dead man. It is," he added, with a muttered oath, still staring at him in a thoughtful manner, "so awful sly."
"So distinct, eh, Dennis?"
"Distinct," he answered, scratching his head and keeping his eyes upon the secretary's face. "I seem to hear it, Muster Gashford, in my wery bones."
"I am very glad your sense of hearing is so sharp, and that I succeed in making myself so intelligible,"
said Gashford, in his unvarying, even tone.
"Where is your friend?"
Mr. Dennis looked round, as in expectation of beholding him asleep upon his bed of straw, then remembering he had seen him go out, replied,
"I can't say where he is, Muster Gashford. I expect him back afore now. I hope it isn't time that we was busy, Muster Gashford."
"Nay," said the secretary, "who should know that as well as you? How can I tell you, Dennis? You are perfect master of your own actions, you know, and accountable to nobody, except sometimes to the law, eh?"
Dennis, who was very much baffled by the cool matter-of-course manner of this reply, recovered his self-possession on his professional pursuits being referred to, and pointing towards Barnaby, shook his head and frowned.
"Hush!" cried Barnaby. "Ah! Do hush about that, Muster Gashford,"
said the hangman in a low voice.
"Popular prejudices. You always forget."
"Well, Barnaby, my lad, what's the matter?"
"I hear him coming," he answered. "Hark! Do you mark that? That's his foot. Bless you, I know his step and his dog's, too. Tramp, tramp, pit-pat. On they come together, and... and here they are!"
he cried joyfully, welcoming Hugh with both hands, and then patting him fondly on the back, as if instead of being the rough companion he was, he had been one of the most prepossessing of men.
"Here he is, and safe too. I'm glad to see him back again, old Hugh.
I'm a Turk if he don't give me a warmer welcome always than any man of sense,
said Hugh, shaking hands with him with a kind of ferocious friendship, strange enough to see.
How are you, boy?
Hearty, cried Barnaby, waving his hat. And merry too, Hugh, and ready to do anything for the good cause and the right, and to help the kind, mild, pale-faced gentleman, the lord they used so ill, eh, Hugh?
Aye,
returned his friend, dropping his hand and looking at Gashford for an instant with a changed expression before he spoke to him.
Good day, master.
And good day to you,
replied the secretary, nursing his leg.
And many good days, whole years of them, I hope. You are heated.
So would you have been, master,
said Hugh, wiping his face,
if you'd been running here as fast as I have.
You know the news, then? Yes, I suppose you would have heard it.
News? What news?
You don't?
Cried Gashford, raising his eyebrows with an exclamation of surprise.
Near me. Come, then I am the first to make you acquainted with your distinguished position, after all. Do you see the King's arms atop?
He smilingly asked, as he took a large paper from his pocket, unfolded it, and held it out for Hugh's inspection.
Well, said Hugh, what's that to me?
Much, a great deal, replied the secretary. Read it.
I told you the first time I saw you that I couldn't read, said Hugh impatiently. What in the devil's name's inside of it?
It is a proclamation from the King in Council, said Gashford, dated today and offering a reward of £500. £500 is a great deal of money, and a large temptation to some people, to anyone who will discover the person or persons most active in demolishing those chapels on Saturday night.
Is that all? Cried Hugh with an indifferent air. Oh, I knew of that.
Truly, I might have known you did,
said Gashford, smiling and folding up the document again.
Your friend, I might have guessed, indeed I did guess, was sure to tell you.
My friend,
stammered Hugh with an unsuccessful effort to appear surprised. What friend?
Tut! Do you suppose I don't know where you have been?
Retorted Gashford, rubbing his hands and beating the back of one on the palm of the other, and looking at him with a cunning eye.
How dull you think me! Shall I say his name?
No,
said Hugh with a hasty glance towards Dennis.
You have also heard from him, no doubt,
resumed the secretary, after a moment's pause,
that the rioters who have been taken, poor fellows, are committed for trial, and that some very active witnesses have had the temerity to appear against them. Among others,
and here he clenched his teeth, as if he would suppress by force some violent words that rose upon his tongue, and spoke very slowly.
Among others, a gentleman who saw the work going on in Warwick Street, a Catholic gentleman, one Haredale.
Hugh would have prevented his uttering the word, but it was out already. Hearing the name, Barnaby turned swiftly round.
"Duty! Duty! Bold Barnaby!"
cried Hugh, assuming his wildest and most rapid manner, and thrusting into his hand his staff and flag, which leant against the wall.
"Mount guard without loss of time, for we are off upon our expedition. Up, Dennis, and get ready. Take care that no one turns the straw upon my bed, brave Barnaby. We know what's underneath it, eh? Now, master, quick! What you have to say, say speedily, for the little captain and a cluster of him are in the fields, and only waiting for us. Drops the word, strikes the action, quick!"
Barnaby was not proof against this bustle and dispatch. The look of mingled astonishment and anger which had appeared in his face when he turned towards them faded from it as the words passed from his memory, like breath from a polished mirror, and grasping the weapon which Hugh forced upon him, he proudly took his station at the door, beyond their hearing.
"You might have spoiled our plans, master," said Hugh. "You, too, of all men! Who would have supposed that he would be so quick?"
urged Gashford.
"He's as quick sometimes, I don't mean with his hands, for that you know, but with his head, as you or any man," said Hugh. "Dennis, it's time we were going. They're waiting for us. I came to tell you. Reach me my stick and belt. Here, lend a hand, master. Fling this over my shoulder and buckle it behind, will you?"
"Brisk as ever,"
said the secretary, adjusting it for him as he desired.
"A man need to be brisk today. There's brisk work afoot."
"There is there?"
said Gashford. He said it with such a provoking assumption of ignorance that Hugh, looking over his shoulder and angrily down upon him, replied,
"Is there? You know there is. Who knows better than you, master, that the first great step to be taken is to make examples of these witnesses, and frighten all men from appearing against us, or any of our body, any more?"
"There's one we know of,"
returned Gashford, with an expressive smile,
"who is at least as well informed upon that subject as you or I.
"If we mean the same gentleman as I suppose we do,"
Hugh rejoined softly,
"I tell you this. He's as good and quick information about everything as—"
Here he paused and looked round, as if to make sure that the person in question was not within hearing,
"as old Nick himself. Have you done that, master? How slow you are!"
"It's quite fast now,"
said Gashford, rising.
"I say, you didn't find that your friend disapproved of today's little expedition?" "It is fortunate it jumps so well with the witness policy, for once planned, it must have been carried out. And now, you are going, eh?"
"Now we are going, master," Hugh replied. "Any parting words?"
"Oh, dear, no,"
said Gashford sweetly. "None."
"You're sure?"
cried Hugh, nudging the grinning Dennis.
"Quite sure, eh, Master Gashford?"
chuckled the hangman. Gashford paused a moment, struggling with his caution and his malice, then putting himself between the two men, and laying a hand upon the arm of each, said in a cramped whisper,
"Do not, my good friends, I'm sure you will not, forget our talk one night in your house, Dennis, about this person. No mercy, no quarter, no two beams of his house to be left standing where the builder placed them. Fire, the saying goes, is a good servant but a bad master. Makes it his master. He deserves no better. But I am sure you will be firm. I am sure you will be very resolute. I am sure you will remember that he thirsts for your lives and those of all your brave companions. If you ever acted like staunch fellows, you will do so today. Won't you, Dennis? Won't you, Hugh?"
The two looked at him and at each other, then bursting into a roar of laughter, brandished their staves above their heads, shook hands, and hurried out. When they had been gone a little time, Gashford followed. They were yet in sight, and hastening to that part of the adjacent fields in which their fellows had already mustered, Hugh was looking back and flourishing his hat to Barnaby, who, delighted with his trust, replied in the same way, and then resumed his pacing up and down before the stable door, where his feet had worn a path already. And when Gashford himself was far distant, and looked back for the last time, he was still walking to and fro, with the same measured tread, the most devoted and the blithest champion that ever maintained a post, and felt his heart lifted up with a brave sense of duty and determination to defend it to the last. Smiling at the simplicity of the poor idiot, Gashford betook himself to Welbeck Street by a different path from that which he knew the rioters would take, and sitting down behind a curtain in one of the upper windows of Lord George Gordon's house, waited impatiently for their coming. They were so long that although he knew it had been settled they should come that way, he had a misgiving they must have changed their plans and taken some other route. But at length the roar of voices was heard in the neighbouring fields, and soon afterwards they came thronging past in a great body. However, they were not all, nor nearly all, in one body, but were, as he soon found, divided into four parties, each of which stopped before the house to give three cheers, and then went on, the leaders crying out in what direction they were going, and calling on the spectators to join them. The first detachment, carrying by way of banners some relics of the havoc they had made in Moorfields, proclaimed that they were on their way to Chelsea, whence they would return in the same order to make of the spoil they bore a great bonfire near at hand. The second gave out that they were bound for Wapping, to destroy a chapel, the third that their place of destination was East Smithfield, and their object the same. All this was done in broad, bright summer day. Gay carriages and chairs stopped to let them pass, or turned back to avoid them. People on foot stood aside in doorways, or perhaps knocked and begged permission to stand at a window, or in the hall, until the rioters had passed. But nobody interfered with them, and when they had gone by, everything went on as usual. There still remained the fourth body, and for that the secretary looked with a most intense eagerness. At last it came up. It was numerous, and composed of picked men, for as he gazed down among them, he recognised many upturned faces which he knew well, those of Simon Tappertit, Hugh, and Dennis in the front, of course. They halted and cheered, as the others had done, but when they moved again, they did not, like them, proclaim what design they had. Hugh merely raised his hat upon the bludgeon he carried, and glancing at a spectator on the opposite side of the way, was gone. Gashford followed the direction of his glance instinctively, and saw, standing on the pavement, and wearing the blue cockade, Sir John Chester. He held his hat an inch or two above his head to propitiate the mob, and, resting gracefully on his cane, smiling pleasantly and displaying his dress and person to the very best advantage, looked on in the most tranquil state imaginable. For all that, and quick and dexterous as he was, Gashford had seen him recognise Hugh with the air of a patron. He had no longer any eyes for the crowd, but fixed his keen regards upon Sir John. He stood in the same place and posture until the last man in the concourse had turned the corner of the street, then very deliberately took the blue cockade out of his hat, put it carefully in his pocket, ready for the next emergency, refreshed himself with a pinch of snuff, put up his box, and was walking slowly off when a passing carriage stopped, and a lady's hand let down the glass. Sir John's hat was off again immediately. After a minute's conversation at the carriage window, in which it was apparent that he was vastly entertaining on the subject of the mob, he stepped lightly in and was driven away. The secretary smiled, but he had other thoughts to dwell upon, and soon dismissed the topic. Dinner was brought him, but he sent it down untasted, and in restless pacings up and down the room, and constant glances at the clock, and many futile efforts to sit down and read, or go to sleep, or look out of the window, consumed four weary hours. When the dial told him thus much time had crept away, he stole upstairs to the top of the house, and coming out upon the roof, sat down with his face towards the east. Heedless of the fresh air that blew upon his heated brow, of the pleasant meadows from which he turned, of the piles of roofs and chimneys upon which he looked, of the smoke and rising mist he vainly sought to pierce, of the shrill cries of children at their evening sports, the distant hum and turmoil of the town, the cheerful country breath that rustled past to meet it, and to droop and die. He watched and watched, till it was dark, save for the specks of light that twinkled in the streets below and far away. And as the darkness deepened, strained his gaze and grew more eager yet.
"Nothing but gloom in that direction still," he muttered restlessly. "Dog, where is the redness in the sky you promised me?"
End of chapter 53. Chapter 54 of Barnaby Rudge, A Tale of the Riots of 80. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recorded by Mill Nicholson. Barnaby Rudge, A Tale of the Riots of 80 by Charles Dickens. Chapter 54. Rumours of the prevailing disturbances had, by this time, begun to be pretty generally circulated through the towns and villages round London, and the tidings were everywhere received with that appetite for the marvellous and love of the terrible which have probably been among the natural characteristics of mankind since the creation of the world. These accounts, however, appeared to many persons at that day, as they would to us at the present, but that we know them to be matter of history, so monstrous and improbable, that a great number of those who were resident at a distance, and who were credulous enough on other points, were really unable to bring their minds to believe that such things could be, and rejected the intelligence they received on all hands as wholly fabulous and absurd. Mr. Willet, not so much perhaps on account of his having argued and settled the matter with himself, as by reason of his constitutional obstinacy, was one of those who positively refused to entertain the current topic for a moment. On this very evening, and perhaps at the very time when Gashford kept his solitary watch, old John was so red in the face with perpetually shaking his head in contradiction of his three ancient cronies and pot-companions, that he was quite a phenomenon to behold, and lighted up the maypole porch wherein they sat together like a monstrous carbuncle in a fairy tale.
"Do you think, sir?" said Mr. Willet, looking hard at Solomon Daisy, for it was his custom in cases of personal altercation to fasten upon the smallest man in the party. "Do you think, sir, that I'm a born fool?"
"No, no, Johnny," returned Solomon, looking round upon the little circle of which he formed a part. "We all know better than that. You're no fool, Johnny. No, no."
Mr. Cobb and Mr. Parkes shook their heads in unison, muttering, "No, no, Johnny, not you." But as such compliments had usually the effect of making Mr. Willet rather more dogged than before, he surveyed them with a look of deep disdain, and returned for answer,
"Then what do you mean by coming here and telling me that this evening you're a-going to walk up to London together? You three, you, and have the evidence of your own senses?"
"Aunt,"
said Mr. Willet, putting his pipe in his mouth with an air of solemn disgust,
"aunt the evidence of my senses enough for you?"
"But we haven't got it, Johnny," pleaded Parkes humbly.
"You haven't got it, sir?"
repeated Mr. Willet, eyeing him from top to toe.
"You haven't got it, sir? You have got it, sir. Don't I tell you that His Blessed Majesty, King George the Third, would no more stand a-rioting and rollicking in his streets than he'd stand being crowed over by his own Parliament?"
"Yes, Johnny, but that's your sense, not your senses,"
said the adventurous Mr. Parkes.
"How do you know?"
retorted John with great dignity.
"You're a-contradicting pretty free, you are, sir. How do you know which it is? I'm not aware I ever told you, sir."
Mr. Parkes, finding himself in the position of having got into metaphysics without exactly seeing his way out of them, stammered forth an apology and retreated from the argument. There then ensued a silence of some 10 minutes, or a quarter of an hour, at the expiration of which period Mr. Willet was observed to rumble and shake with laughter, and presently remarked, in reference to his late adversary, that he hoped he had tackled him enough. Thereupon Messrs. Cobb and Daisy laughed and nodded, and Parkes was looked upon as thoroughly and effectually put down.
"Do you suppose, if all this was true, that Mr. Haredale would be constantly away from home as he is?"
said John, after another silence.
Do you think he wouldn't be afraid to leave his house with them two young women in it, and only a couple of men or so? Aye, but then you know, returned Solomon Daisy, his house is a goodish way out of London, and they do say that the rioters won't go more than 2 miles, or three at the farthest, off the stones. Besides, you know, some of the Catholic gentlefolks have actually sent trinkets and such like down here for safety. At least, so the story goes.
The story goes, said Mr. Willet testily. Yes, sir. The story goes that you saw a ghost last March, but nobody believes it.
Well, said Solomon, rising to divert the attention of his two friends, who tittered at this retort, believed or disbelieved, it's true. And true or not, if we mean to go to London, we must be going at once. So, shake hands, Johnny, and good night.
I shall shake hands, returned the landlord, putting his into his pockets, with no man as goes to London on such nonsensical errands.
The three cronies were therefore reduced to the necessity of shaking his elbows. Having performed that ceremony, and brought from the house their hats and sticks and greatcoats, they bade him good night and departed, promising to bring him on the morrow full and true accounts of the real state of the city, and if it were quiet, to give him the full merit of his victory. John Willet looked after them, as they plodded along the road in the rich glow of a summer evening, and knocking the ashes out of his pipe, laughed inwardly at their folly until his sides were sore. When he had quite exhausted himself, which took some time, for he laughed as slowly as he thought and spoke, he sat himself comfortably with his back to the house, put his legs upon the bench, then his apron over his face, and fell sound asleep. How long he slept matters not, but it was for no brief space, for when he awoke the rich light had faded, the sombre hues of night were falling fast upon the landscape, and a few bright stars were already twinkling overhead. The birds were all at roost, the daisies on the green had closed their fairy hoods, the honeysuckle twining round the porch exhaled its perfume in a twofold degree, as though it lost its coyness at that silent time, and loved to shed its fragrance on the night. The ivy scarcely stirred its deep green leaves. How tranquil and how beautiful it was! Was there no sound in the air, besides the gentle rustling of the trees and the grasshopper's merry chirp? Hark! Something very faint and distant, not unlike the murmuring in a seashell. Now it grew louder, fainter now, and now it altogether died away. Presently it came again, subsided, came once more, grew louder, fainter, swelled into a roar. It was on the road, and varied with its windings. All at once it burst into a distinct sound, the voices and the tramping feet of many men. It is questionable whether old John Willet, even then, would have thought of the rioters, but for the cries of his cook and housemaid, who ran screaming upstairs and locked themselves into one of the old garrets, shrieking dismally when they had done so, by way of rendering their place of refuge perfectly secret and secure. These two females did afterwards depone that Mr. Willet, in his consternation, uttered but one word, and called that up the stairs in a stentorian voice 6 distinct times. But as this word was a monosyllable, which, however inoffensive when applied to the quadruped it denotes, is highly reprehensible when used in connection with females of unimpeachable character. Many persons were inclined to believe that the young women laboured under some hallucination caused by excessive fear, and that their ears deceived them. Be this as it may, John Willet, in whom the very uttermost extent of dull-headed perplexity supplied the place of courage, stationed himself in the porch and waited for their coming up. Once it dimly occurred to him that there was a kind of door to the house, which had a lock and bolts, and at the same time some shadowy ideas of shutters to the lower windows flitted through his brain. But he stood stock still, looking down the road in the direction which the noise was rapidly advancing, and did not so much as take his hands out of his pockets. He had not to wait long. A dark mass, looming through a cloud of dust, soon became visible.
The mob quickened their pace, shouting and whooping like savages. They came rushing on pell-mell, and in a few seconds he was bandied from hand to hand in the heart of a crowd of men.
"Hello!"
cried a voice he knew, as the man who spoke came cleaving through the throng.
"Where is he? Give him to me. Don't hurt him. How now, old Jack?"
Mr. Willet looked at him, and saw it was Hugh, but he said nothing and thought nothing.
"These lads are thirsty and must drink,"
cried Hugh, thrusting him back towards the house.
"Bustle, Jack, bustle. Show us the best, the very best, the overproof that you keep for your own drinking, Jack."
John faintly articulated the words,
"Who's to pay?" "He says, who's to pay?"
cried Hugh with a roar of laughter which was loudly echoed by the crowd. Then turning to John, he added,
"Pay? Why, nobody."
John stared round at the mass of faces, some grinning, some fierce, some lighted up by torches, some indistinct, some dusky and shadowy, some looking at him, some at his house, some at each other. And while he was, as he thought, in the very act of doing so, found himself without any consciousness of having moved in the bar, sitting down in an armchair, and watching the destruction of his property, as if it were some queer play or entertainment, of an astonishing and stupefying nature, but having no reference to himself that he could make out at all. Yes, here was the bar. The bar that the boldest never entered without special invitation. The sanctuary, the mystery, the hallowed ground. Here it was, crammed with men, clubs, sticks, torches, pistols, filled with a deafening noise, oaths, shouts, screams, hootings, changed all at once into a bear garden, a madhouse, an infernal temple, men darting in and out by door and window, smashing the glass, turning the taps, drinking liquor out of china punch bowls, sitting astride of casks, smoking private and personal pipes, cutting down the sacred grove of lemons, hacking and hewing at the celebrated cheese, breaking open inviolable drawers, putting things in their pockets which didn't belong to them, dividing his own money before his own eyes, wantonly wasting, breaking, pulling down and tearing up. Nothing quiet, nothing private. Men everywhere, above, below, overhead, in the bedrooms, in the kitchen, in the yard, in the stables, clambering in at windows when there were doors wide open, dropping out of windows when the stairs were handy, leaping over the banisters into chasms of passages, new faces and figures presenting themselves every instant, some yelling, some singing, some fighting, some breaking glass and crockery, some laying the dust with the liquor they couldn't drink, some ringing the bells till they pulled them down, others beating them with pokers till they beat them into fragments. More men still, more, 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 swarming on like insects, noise, smoke, light, darkness, frolic, anger, laughter, groans, plunder, fear, and ruin. Nearly all the time while John looked on at this bewildering scene, Hugh kept near him, and though he was the loudest, wildest, most destructive villain there, he saved his old master's bones a score of times. Nay, even when Mr. Tappertit, excited by liquor, came up and, in assertion of his prerogative, politely kicked old John Willet on the shins, Hugh bade him return the compliment, and if old John had had sufficient presence of mind to understand this whispered direction and to profit by it, he might no doubt, under Hugh's protection, have done so with impunity. At length the band began to reassemble outside the house, and to call to those within to join them, for they were losing time. These murmurs increasing and attaining a high pitch, Hugh and some of those who yet lingered in the bar, and who plainly were the leaders of the troop, took counsel together, apart, as to what was to be done with John to keep him quiet until their Chigwell work was over. Some proposed to set the house on fire and leave him in it, others that he should be reduced to a state of temporary insensibility by knocking on the head, others that he should be sworn to sit where he was until tomorrow at the same hour, others again that he should be gagged and taken off with them under a sufficient guard. All these propositions being overruled, it was concluded at last to bind him in his chair, and a word was passed for Dennis.
"Look here, Jack," said Hugh, striding up to him. "We are going to tie you, hand and foot, but otherwise you won't be hurt. Do you hear?"
John Willet looked at another man, as if he didn't know which was the speaker, and muttered something about an ordinary every Sunday at 2 o'clock.
"You won't be hurt, I tell you. Jack, do you hear me?"
roared Hugh, impressing the assurance upon him by means of a heavy blow on the back.
"He's so dead scared, he's wool-gathering, I think. Give him a drop of something to drink here. Hand over, one of you."
A glass of liquor being passed forward, Hugh poured the contents down old John's throat. Mr. Willet feebly smacked his lips, thrust his hand into his pocket, and inquired what was to pay, adding, as he looked vacantly round, that he believed there was a trifle of broken glass.
"He's out of his senses for the time, it's my belief,"
said Hugh, after shaking him, without any visible effect upon his system, until his keys rattled in his pocket.
"Where's that Dennis?"
The word was again passed, and presently Mr. Dennis, with a long cord bound about his middle, something after the manner of a friar, came hurrying in, attended by a bodyguard of half a dozen of his men.
"Come, be alive here!"
cried Hugh, stamping his foot upon the ground. "Make haste!" Dennis, with a wink and a nod, unwound the cord from about his person, and raising his eyes to the ceiling, looked all over it, and round the walls and cornice, with a curious eye, then shook his head.
"Move, man, can't you?"
cried Hugh, with another impatient stamp of his foot.
"Are we to wait here till the cry has gone for 10 miles round, and our work's interrupted?"
"It's all very fine talking, brother,"
answered Dennis, stepping towards him.
"But unless—"
here he whispered in his ear—"unless
we do it over the door, it can't be done at all in this here room."
"What can't?"
Hugh demanded.
"What can't?" retorted Dennis. "Why, the old man can't."
"Why, you weren't going to hang him?"
cried Hugh.
"No, brother,"
returned the hangman with a stare.
"What else?"
Hugh made no answer, but snatching the rope from his companion's hand, proceeded to bind old John himself. But his very first move was so bungling and unskilful that Mr. Dennis entreated almost with tears in his eyes that he might be permitted to perform the duty. Hugh consenting, he achieved it in a twinkling.
"There,"
he said, looking mournfully at John Willet, who displayed no more emotion in his bonds than he had shown out of them.
"That's what I call pretty and workmanlike. He's quite a picture now. But, brother, just a word with you, now that he's ready trussed, as one may say, wouldn't it be better for all parties if we was to work him off? It would read uncommon well in the newspapers, it would indeed. The public would think a great deal more on us."
Hugh, inferring what his companion meant, rather from his gestures than his technical mode of expressing himself, to which, as he was ignorant of his calling, he wanted the clue, rejected this proposition for the second time, and gave the word "forward," which was echoed by 100 voices from without.
"To the warren!"
shouted Dennis as he ran out, followed by the rest.
"A witness is out, my lads!"
A loud yell followed, and the whole throng hurried off, mad for pillage and destruction. Hugh lingered behind for a few moments, to stimulate himself with more drink, and to set all the taps running, a few of which had accidentally been spared. Then, glancing round the despoiled and plundered room, through whose shattered window the rioters had thrust the maypole itself, for even that had been sawn down, lighted a torch, clapped the mute and motionless John Willet on the back, and waving his light above his head, and uttering a fierce shout, hastened after his companions. End of chapter 54. Chapter 55 of Barnaby Rudge, A Tale of the Riots of 80. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recorded by Mill Nicholson. Barnaby Rudge, A Tale of the Riots of 80 by Charles Dickens. Chapter 55. John Willet, left alone in his dismantled bar, continued to sit staring about him, awake as to his eyes, certainly, but with all his powers of reason and reflection in a sound and dreamless sleep. He looked round upon the room which had been for years, and was, within an hour ago, the pride of his heart, and not a muscle of his face was moved. The night without looked black and cold through the dreary gaps in the casement. The precious liquids, now nearly leaked away, dripped with a hollow sound upon the floor. The maypole peered ruefully in through the broken window, like the bowsprit of a wrecked ship. The ground might have been the bottom of the sea, it was so strewn with precious fragments. Currents of air rushed in, as the old doors jarred and creaked upon their hinges. The candles flickered and guttered down, and made long winding sheets. The cheery deep red curtains flapped and fluttered idly in the wind. Even the stout Dutch kegs, overthrown and lying empty in dark corners, seemed the mere husks of good fellows whose jollity had departed, and who could kindle with a friendly glow no more. John saw this desolation, and yet saw it not. He was perfectly contented to sit there, staring at it, and felt no more indignation or discomfort in his bonds than if they had been robes of honour. So far as he was personally concerned, old time lay snoring, and the world stood still. Save for the dripping from the barrels, the rustling of such light fragments of destruction as the wind affected, and the dull creaking of the open doors, all was profoundly quiet. Indeed, these sounds, like the ticking of the death watch in the night, only made the silence they invaded deeper and more apparent. But quiet or noisy, it was all one to John. If a train of heavy artillery could have come up and commenced ball practice outside the window, it would have been all the same to him. He was a long way beyond surprise. A ghost couldn't have overtaken him. By and by he heard a footstep, a hurried and yet cautious footstep, coming on towards the house. It stopped, advanced again, and seemed to go quite round it. Having done that, it came beneath the window, and a head looked in. It was strongly relieved against the darkness outside by the glare of the guttering candles. A pale, worn, withered face. The eyes, but that was owing to its gaunt condition, unnaturally large and bright, the hair a grizzled black. It gave a searching glance all round the room, and a deep voice said, "Are you alone in this house?" John made no sign, though the question was repeated twice, and he heard it distinctly. After a moment's pause, the man got in at the window. John was not at all surprised at this either. There had been so much getting in and out of window in the course of the last hour or so, that he had quite forgotten the door, and seemed to have lived among such exercises from infancy. The man wore a large, dark, faded cloak, and a slouched hat. He walked up close to John, and looked at him. John returned the compliment with interest.
"How long have you been sitting thus?" said the man.
John considered, but nothing came of it.
"Which way have the party gone?"
Some wandering speculations relative to the fashion of the stranger's boots got into Mr. Willet's mind by some accident or other, but they got out again in a hurry, and left him in his former state.
"You would do well to speak," said the man. "You may keep a whole skin, though you have nothing else left that can be hurt. Which way have the party gone?"
"That,"
said John, finding his voice all at once, and nodding with perfect good faith. He couldn't point, he was so tightly bound in exactly the opposite direction to the right one.
"You lie," said the man angrily and with a threatening gesture. "I came that way. You would betray me?"
It was so evident that John's imperturbability was not assumed, but was the result of the late proceedings under his roof, that the man stayed his hand in the very act of striking him, and turned away. John looked after him without so much as a twitch in a single nerve of his face. He seized a glass, and holding it under one of the little casks until a few drops were collected, drank them greedily off, and throwing it down upon the floor impatiently, he took the vessel in his hands and drained it into his throat. Some scraps of bread and meat were scattered about, and on these he fell next, eating them with voracity and pausing every now and then to listen for some fancied noise outside. When he had refreshed himself in this manner, with violent haste, and raised another barrel to his lips, he pulled his hat upon his brow, as though he were about to leave the house, and turned to John.
"Where are your servants?"
Mr. Willet indistinctly remembered to have heard the rioters calling to them to throw the key of the room in which they were out of window for their keeping. He therefore replied,
"Locked up." "Well, for them, if they remain quiet, and well for you if you do the like," said the man. "Now, show me the way the party went."
This time Mr. Willet indicated it correctly. The man was hurrying to the door, when suddenly there came towards them on the wind the loud and rapid tolling of an alarm bell, and then a bright and vivid glare streamed up, which illumined not only the whole chamber, but all the country. It was not the sudden change from darkness to this dreadful light. It was not the sound of distant shrieks and shouts of triumph. It was not this dread invasion of the serenity and peace of night that drove the man back as though a thunderbolt had struck him. It was the bell. If the ghastliest shape the human mind has ever pictured in its wildest dreams had risen up before him, he could not have staggered backward from its touch, as he did from the first sound of that loud iron voice. With eyes that started from his head, his limbs convulsed, his face most horrible to see, he raised one arm high up into the air, and holding something visionary back and down with his other hand, drove at it as though he held a knife and stabbed it to the heart. He clutched his hair, and stopped his ears, and travelled madly round and round, and gave a frightful cry, and with it rushed away. Still the bell tolled on, and seemed to follow him, louder and louder, hotter and hotter yet. The glare grew brighter, the roar of voices deeper, the crash of heavy bodies falling shook the air. Bright streams of sparks rose up into the sky, but louder than them all, rising faster far to heaven, a million times more fierce and furious, pouring forth dreadful secrets after its long silence, speaking the language of the dead, the bell, the bell. What hunt of spectres could surpass that dread pursuit and flight? Had there been a legion of them on his track, he could have better borne it. They would have had a beginning and an end. But here all space was full. The one pursuing voice was everywhere. It sounded in the earth, the air, shook the long grass, and howled among the trembling trees. The echoes caught it up. The owls hooted as it flew upon the breeze. The nightingale was silent, and hid herself among the thickest boughs. It seemed to goad and urge the angry fire, and lash it into madness. Everything was steeped in one prevailing red. The glow was everywhere. Nature was drenched in blood. Still the remorseless crying, that awful voice, the bell, the bell. It ceased, but not in his ears. The knell was at his heart. No work of man had ever voice like that which sounded there, and warned him that it cried unceasingly to heaven. Who could hear that bell and not know what it said? There was murder in its every note, cruel, relentless, savage murder, the murder of a confiding man by one who held his every trust. Its ringing summoned phantoms from their graves. What face was that, in which a friendly smile changed to a look of half-incredulous horror, which stiffened for a moment into one of pain, then changed again into an imploring glance at heaven, and so fell idly down with upturned eyes, like the dead stags he had often peeped at when a little child, shrinking and shuddering. There was a dreadful thing to think of now. And clinging to an apron as he looked, he sank upon the ground, and grovelling down as if he would dig himself a place to hide in, covered his face and ears. But no, 100 walls and roofs of brass would not shut out that bell, for in it spoke the wrathful voice of God, and from that voice the whole wide universe could not afford a refuge. While he rushed up and down, not knowing where to turn, and while he lay crouching there, the work went briskly on indeed. When they left the maypole, the rioters formed into a solid body, and advanced at a quick pace toward the warren. Rumour of their approach having gone before, they found the garden doors fast closed, the windows made secure, and the house profoundly dark, not a light being visible in any portion of the building. After some fruitless ringing at the bells and beating at the iron gates, they drew off a few paces to reconnoitre, and confer upon the course it would be best to take. Very little conference was needed, when all were bent upon one desperate purpose, infuriated with liquor and flushed with successful riot. The word being given to surround the house, some climbed the gates or dropped into the shallow trench and scaled the garden wall, while others pulled down the solid iron fence, and while they made a breach to enter by, made deadly weapons of the bars. The house being completely encircled, a small number of men were dispatched to break open a tool shed in the garden, and during their absence on this errand, the remainder contented themselves with knocking violently at the doors and calling to those within to come down and open them on peril of their lives. No answer being returned to this repeated summons, and the detachment who had been sent away coming back with an accession of pickaxes, spades, and hoes, they, together with those who had such arms already, or carried, as many did, axes, poles, and crowbars, struggled into the foremost rank, ready to beset the doors and windows. They had not at this time more than a dozen lighted torches among them, but when these preparations were completed, flaming links were distributed and passed from hand to hand with such rapidity that in a minute's time at least two-thirds of the whole roaring mass bore, each man in his hand, a blazing brand. Whirling these about their heads, they raised a loud shout and fell to work upon the doors and windows. Amidst the clattering of heavy blows, the rattling of broken glass, the cries and execrations of the mob, and all the din and turmoil of the scene, Hugh and his friends kept together at the turret door, where Mr. Haredale had last admitted him and old John Willet, and spent their united force on that. It was a strong old oaken door, guarded by good bolts and a heavy bar, but it soon went crashing in upon the narrow stairs behind, and made, as it were, a platform to facilitate their tearing up into the rooms above. Almost at the same moment, a dozen other points were forced, and at every one the crowd poured in like water. A few armed servant-men were posted in the hall, and when the rioters forced an entrance there, they fired some half a dozen shots. But these taking no effect, and the concourse coming on like an army of devils, they only thought of consulting their own safety, and retreated, echoing their assailants' cries, and hoping in the confusion to be taken for rioters themselves, in which stratagem they succeeded, with the exception of one old man, who was never heard of again, and was said to have had his brains beaten out with an iron bar. One of his fellows reported that he had seen the old man fall, and to have been afterwards burnt in the flames. The besiegers, being now in complete possession of the house, spread themselves over it from garret to cellar, and plied their demon labours fiercely. While some small parties kindled bonfires underneath the windows, others broke up the furniture and cast the fragments down to feed the flames below. Where the apertures in the wall, windows no longer, were large enough, they threw out tables, chests of drawers, beds, mirrors, pictures, and flung them whole into the fire, while every fresh addition to the blazing masses was received with shouts and howls and yells, which added new and dismal terrors to the conflagration. Those who had axes and had spent their fury on the movables, chopped and tore down the doors and window frames, broke up the flooring, hewed away the rafters, and buried men who lingered in the upper rooms in heaps of ruins. Some searched the drawers, the chests, the boxes, writing desks and closets for jewels, plate, and money, while others, less mindful of gain and more mad for destruction, cast their whole contents into the courtyard without examination, and called to those below to heap them on the blaze. Men who had been into the cellars and had staved the casks rushed to and fro stark mad, setting fire to all they saw, often to the dresses of their own friends, and kindling the building in so many parts that some had no time for escape, and were seen with drooping hands and blackened faces hanging senseless on the window-sills to which they had crawled, until they were sucked and drawn into the burning gulf. The more the fire crackled and raged, the wilder and more cruel the men grew, as though moving in that element they became fiends, and change their earthly nature for the qualities that give delight in hell. The burning pile, revealing rooms and passages red-hot, through gaps made in the crumbling walls, the tributary fires that licked the outer bricks and stones with their long forked tongues, and ran up to meet the glowing mass within, the shining of the flames upon the villains who looked on and fed them, the roaring of the angry blaze, so bright and high that it seemed in its rapacity to have swallowed up the very smoke, the living flakes the wind bore rapidly away and hurried on with, like a storm of fiery snow, the noiseless breaking of great beams of wood, which fell like feathers on the heap of ashes, and crumbled in the very act to sparks and powder, the lurid tinge that overspread the sky, and the darkness, very deep by contrast, which prevailed around, the exposure to the coarse, common gaze of every little nook which usages of home had made a sacred place, and the destruction by rude hands of every little household favourite which old associations made a dear and precious thing. All this taking place, not among pitying looks and friendly murmurs of compassion, but brutal shouts and exultations, which seemed to make the very rats who stood by the old house too long, creatures with some claim upon the pity and regard of those its roof had sheltered, combined to form a scene, never to be forgotten by those who saw it and were not actors in the work, so long as life endured. And who were they? The alarm bell rang, and it was pulled by no faint or hesitating hands, for a long time, but not a soul was seen. Some of the insurgents said that when it ceased, they heard the shrieks of women, and saw some garments fluttering in the air, as a party of men bore away no unresisting burdens. No one could say that this was true or false, in such an uproar. But where was Hugh? Who among them had seen him since the forcing of the doors? The cry spread through the body. Where was Hugh?
"Here!"
he hoarsely cried, appearing from the darkness, out of breath and blackened with the smoke.
We've done all we can. The fire has burning itself out, and even the corners it hasn't spread are nothing but heaps of ruins. Disperse, my lads, while the coast's clear. Get back by different ways, and meet as usual."
With that he disappeared again, contrary to his wont, for he was always first to advance and last to go away, leaving them to follow homewards as they would. It was not an easy task to draw off such a throng. If Bedlam gates had been flung wide open, there would not have issued forth such maniacs as the frenzy of that night had made. There were men there who danced and trampled on the beds of flowers as though they trod down human enemies, and wrenched them from the stalks like savages who twisted human necks. There were men who cast their lighted torches in the air and suffered them to fall upon their heads and faces, blistering the skin with deep unseemly burns. There were men who rushed up to the fire and paddled in it with their hands as if in water, and others who were restrained by force from plunging in to gratify their deadly longing. On the skull of one drunken lad, not 20 by his looks, who lay upon the ground with a bottle to his mouth, the lead from the roof came streaming down in a shower of liquid fire, white-hot, melting his head like wax. When the scattered parties were collected, men, living yet, but singed as if with hot irons, were plucked out of the cellars and carried off upon the shoulders of others, who strove to wake them as they went along, with ribald jokes, and left them, dead, in the passages of hospitals. But of all the howling throng, not one learnt mercy from, or sickened at, these sights, nor was the fierce, besotted, senseless rage of one man glutted. Slowly, and in small clusters, with hoarse hurrahs and repetitions of their usual cry, the assembly dropped away. The last few red-eyed stragglers reeled after those who had gone before. The distant noise of men calling to each other, and whistling for others whom they missed, grew fainter and fainter. At length, even these sounds died away, and silence reigned alone. Silence indeed. The glare of the flames had sunk into a fitful, flashing light, and the gentle stars, invisible till now, looked down upon the blackening heap. A dull smoke hung upon the ruin, as though to hide it from those eyes of heaven, and the wind forbore to move it. bare walls, roof open to the sky, chambers where the beloved dead had, many and many a fair day, risen to new life and energy, where so many dear ones had been sad and merry, which were connected with so many thoughts and hopes, regrets and changes, all gone. Nothing left but a dull and dreary blank, a smouldering heap of dust and ashes, the silence and solitude of utter desolation. End of chapter 55. Chapter 56 of Barnaby Rudge, A Tale of the Riots of 80. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recorded by Mill Nicholson. Barnaby Rudge, A Tale of the Riots of 80 by Charles Dickens. Chapter 56. The Maypole cronies, little dreaming of the change so soon to come upon their favourite haunt, struck through the forest path upon their way to London, and avoiding the main road, which was hot and dusty, kept to the bypaths and the fields. As they drew nearer to their destination, they began to make inquiries of the people whom they passed concerning the riots and the truth or falsehood of the stories they had heard. The answers went far beyond any intelligence that had spread to quiet Chigwell. One man told them that that afternoon the guards, conveying to Newgate some rioters who had been re-examined, had been set upon by the mob and compelled to retreat. Another, at the houses of two witnesses near Claremarket, were about to be pulled down when he came away. Another, that Sir George Saville's house in Leicester Fields was to be burnt that night, and that it would go hard with Sir George if he fell into the people's hands, as it was he who had brought in the Catholic Bill. All accounts agreed that the mob were out in stronger numbers and more numerous parties than had yet appeared, that the streets were unsafe, that no man's house or life was worth an hour's purchase, that the public consternation was increasing every moment, and that many families had already fled the city. One fellow, who wore the popular colour, damned them for not having cockades in their hats, and bade them set a good watch tomorrow night upon their prison doors, for the locks would have a straining. Another asked if they were fireproof, that they walked abroad without the distinguishing mark of all good and true men, and a third, who rode on horseback, and was quite alone, ordered them to throw each man a shilling in his hat towards the support of the rioters. Although they were afraid to refuse compliance with this demand, and were much alarmed by these reports, they agreed, having come so far, to go forward and see the real state of things with their own eyes. So they pushed on quicker, as men do who are excited by portentous news, and ruminating on what they had heard, spoke little to each other. It was now night, and as they came nearer to the city, they had dismal confirmation of this intelligence in three great fires, all close together, which burnt fiercely and were gloomily reflected in the sky. Arriving in the immediate suburbs, they found that almost every house had chalked upon its door in large characters, "No Popery," that the shops were shut, and that alarm and anxiety were depicted in every face they passed. Noting these things with a degree of apprehension which neither of the three cared to impart in its full extent to his companions, they came to a turnpike gate which was shut. They were passing through the turnstile on the path, when a horseman rode up from London at a hard gallop, and called to the tollkeeper in a voice of great agitation to open quickly in the name of God. The adjuration was so earnest and vehement that the man, with a lantern in his hand, came running out, tollkeeper though he was, and was about to throw the gate open, when happening to look behind him, he exclaimed,
"Good heaven! What's that? Another fire?"
At this the three turned their heads, and saw in the distance, straight in the direction whence they had come, a broad sheet of flame casting a threatening light upon the clouds, which glimmered as though the conflagration were behind them, and showed like a wrathful sunset.
"My mind misgives me," said the horseman, "or I know from what far building those flames come. Don't stand aghast, my good fellow. Open the gate."
"Sir,"
cried the man, laying his hand upon his horse's bridle as he let him through. "I know you now, sir. Be advised by me. Do not go on. I saw them pass, and know what kind of men they are. You will be murdered."
"So be it,"
said the horseman, looking intently towards the fire, and not at him who spoke. "But, sir, sir!" cried the man, grasping at his rein more tightly yet. "If you do go on, wear the blue riband here, sir," he added, taking one from his own hat. "It's necessity, not choice, that makes me wear it. It's love of life and home, sir. Wear it for this one night, sir, only for this one night." "Do!" cried the three friends, pressing round his horse. "Mr. Haredale, worthy sir, good gentleman, pray be persuaded."
"Who's that?"
cried Mr. Haredale, stooping down to look.
"Did I hear Daisy's voice?"
"You did, sir,"
cried the little man.
"Do be persuaded, sir. This gentleman says very true. Your life may hang upon it."
"Are you," said Mr. Haredale abruptly, "afraid to come with me?"
"I, sir? No!"
"Put that riband in your hat. If we meet the rioters, swear that I took you prisoner for wearing it. I will tell them so with my own lips, for as I hope for mercy when I die, I will take no quarter from them, nor shall they have quarter from me, if we come hand to hand to-night. Up here, behind me, quick! Clasp me tight round the body, and fear nothing."
In an instant they were riding away at full gallop, in a dense cloud of dust, and speeding on like hunters in a dream. It was well the good horse knew the road he traversed, for never once, no, never once in all the journey, did Mr. Haredale cast his eyes upon the ground, or turn them for an instant from the light towards which they sped so madly. Once he said in a low voice, "It is my house." But that was the only time he spoke. When they came to dark and doubtful places, he never forgot to put his hand upon the little man to hold him more securely in his seat, but he kept his head erect and his eyes fixed on the fire, then and always. The road was dangerous enough, for they went the nearest way, headlong, far from the highway, by lonely lanes and paths, where wagon wheels had worn deep ruts, where hedge and ditch hemmed in the narrow strip of ground, and tall trees arching overhead made it profoundly dark. But on, with neither stop nor stumble, till they reached the Maypole door, and could plainly see that the fire began to fade, as if for want of fuel.
"Down, for one moment, for but one moment,"
said Mr. Haredale, helping Daisy to the ground, and following himself. "Will it?
Will it? Where are my niece and servants? Will it?"
Crying to him distractedly, he rushed into the bar. The landlord bound and fastened to his chair, the place dismantled, stripped, and pulled about his ears. Nobody could have taken shelter here. He was a strong man, accustomed to restrain himself and suppress his strong emotions, but this preparation for what was to follow, though he had seen that fire burning and knew that his house must be razed to the ground, was more than he could bear. He covered his face with his hands for a moment and turned away his head.
"Johnny! Johnny!"
said Solomon, and the simple-hearted fellow cried outright and wrung his hands.
"Oh, dear old Johnny, here's a change! At the Maypole Bar should come to this, and we should live to see it. The old Warren too, Johnny, Mr. Haredale. Oh, Johnny, what a piteous sight this is!"
Pointing to Mr. Haredale as he said these words, little Solomon Daisy put his elbows on the back of Mr. Willet's chair and fairly blubbered on his shoulder. While Solomon was speaking, old John sat, mute as a stockfish, staring at him with an unearthly glare, and displaying, by every possible symptom, entire and complete unconsciousness. But when Solomon was silent again, John followed with his great round eyes the direction of his looks, and did appear to have some dawning distant notion that somebody had come to see him.
"You know us, don't you, Johnny?"
said the little clerk, rapping himself on the breast.
"Daisy, you know? Chigwell Church, bell-ringer, little desk on Sundays, eh, Johnny?"
Mr. Willet reflected for a few moments, and then muttered, as it were mechanically,
let us sing to the praise and glory of—
Yes, to be sure, cried the little man hastily. That's it, that's me, Johnny. You're all right now, aren't you? Say you're all right, Johnny.
All right, pondered Mr. Willet, as if that were a matter entirely between himself and his conscience. All right. Ah.
They haven't been misusing you with sticks or pokers or any other blunt instruments, have they, Johnny?
Asked Solomon, with a very anxious glance at Mr. Willet's head.
They didn't beat you, did they?
John knitted his brow, looked downwards as if he were mentally engaged in some arithmetical calculation, then upwards as if the total would not come at his call. Then at Solomon Daisy, from his eyebrow to his shoe buckle, then very slowly round the bar. And then a great, round, leaden-looking, and not at all transparent tear came rolling out of each eye, and he said, as he shook his head,
"If they'd only had the goodness to murder me, I'd have thanked him kindly."
"No, no, no, don't say that, Johnny," whimpered his little friend. "It's very, very bad, but not quite so bad as that. No, no."
"Look'ee here, sir," cried John, turning his rueful eyes on Mr. Haredale, who had dropped on one knee and was hastily beginning to untie his bonds.
"Look'ee here, sir. The very maypole, the old dumb maypole, stares in at the winder as if it said, 'John Willet, John Willet, let's go and pitch ourselves in the nighest pool of water as is deep enough to hold us, for our day is over.'"
"Don't, Johnny, don't!"
cried his friend, no less affected with this mournful effort of Mr. Willet's imagination than by the sepulchral tone in which he had spoken of the maypole.
"Please don't, Johnny!"
"Your loss is great, and your misfortune a heavy one," said Mr. Haredale, looking restlessly towards the door, "and this is not a time to comfort you. If it were, I am in no condition to do so. Before I leave you, tell me one thing, and try to tell me plainly, I implore you. Have you seen or heard of Emma?"
"No," said Mr. Willet, "nor anyone but these bloodhounds."
"No?
They rode away, I trust in heaven, before these dreadful scenes began," said Mr. Haredale, who, between his agitation, his eagerness to mount his horse again, and the dexterity with which the cords were tied, had scarcely yet undone one knot.
"A knife, Daisy."
"You didn't,"
said John, looking about, as though he had lost his pocket-handkerchief or some such slight article.
"Either of you gentlemen see a coffin anywheres, did you?"
"Will it?" cried Mr. Haredale. Solomon dropped the knife, and instantly becoming limp from head to foot, exclaimed,
"Good gracious!"
"Because," said John, not at all regarding them, "a dead man called a little time ago, on his way yonder. I could have told you what name was on the plate, if he had brought his coffin with him and left it behind. If he didn't, it don't signify."
His landlord, who had listened to these words with breathless attention, started that moment to his feet, and, without a word, drew Solomon Daisy to the door, mounted his horse, took him up behind again, and flew rather than galloped towards the pile of ruins which that day's sun had shone upon a stately house. Mr. Willet stared after them, listened, looked down upon himself to make quite sure that he was still unbound, and, without any manifestation of impatience, disappointment or surprise, gently relapsed into the condition from which he had so imperfectly recovered. Mr. Haredale tied his horse to the trunk of a tree, and grasping his companion's arm, stole softly along the footpath, and into what had been the garden of his house. He stopped for an instant to look upon its smoking walls, and at the stars that shone through roof and floor, upon the heap of crumbling ashes. Solomon glanced timidly in his face, but his lips were tightly pressed together, a resolute and stern expression sat upon his brow, and not a tear, a look,
or gesture indicating grief escaped him. He drew his sword, felt for a moment in his breast, as though he carried other arms about him, then grasping Solomon by the wrist again, went with a cautious step all round the house. He looked into every doorway and gap in the wall, retraced his steps at every rustling of the air among the leaves, and searched in every shadowed nook with outstretched hands. Thus they made the circuit of the building, but they returned to the spot from which they had set out without encountering any human being or finding the least trace of any concealed straggler. After a short pause, Mr. Haredale shouted twice or thrice, then cried aloud,
"Is there any one in hiding here who knows my voice? There is nothing to fear now. If any of my people are near, I entreat them to answer."
He called them all by name. His voice was echoed in many mournful tones. Then all was silent as before. They were standing near the foot of the turret, where the alarm bell hung. The fire had raged there, and the floors had been sawn and hewn and beaten down besides. It was open to the night, but a part of the staircase still remained, winding upward from a great mound of dust and cinders. Fragments of the jagged and broken steps offered an insecure and giddy footing here and there, and then were lost again behind protruding angles of the wall, or in the deep shadows cast upon it by other portions of the ruin, for by this time the moon had risen and shone brightly. As they stood here, listening to the echoes as they died away, and hoping in vain to hear a voice they knew, some of the ashes in this turret slipped and rolled down. Startled by the least noise in that melancholy place, Solomon looked up in his companion's face, and saw that he had turned towards the spot, and that he watched and listened keenly. He covered the little man's mouth with his hand, and looked again. Instantly, with kindling eyes, he bade him on his life keep still, and neither speak nor move. Then, holding his breath, and stooping down, he stole into the turret with his drawn sword in his hand, and disappeared. Terrified to be left there by himself under such desolate circumstances, and after all he had seen and heard that night, Solomon would have followed. But there had been something in Mr. Haredale's manner and his look, the recollection of which held him spellbound. He stood rooted to the spot, and scarcely venturing to breathe, looked up with mingled fear and wonder. Again the ashes slipped and rolled, very softly, again, and then again, as though they crumbled underneath the tread of a stealthy foot. And now a figure was dimly visible, climbing very softly, and often stopping to look down. Now it pursued its difficult way, and now it was hidden from the view again. It emerged once more into the shadowy and uncertain light, higher now, but not much, for the way was steep and toilsome, and its progress very slow. What phantom of the brain did he pursue, and why did he look down so constantly? He knew he was alone. Surely his mind was not affected by that night's loss and agony. He was not about to throw himself headlong from the summit of the tottering wall. Solomon turned sick, and clasped his hands. His limbs trembled beneath him, and a cold sweat broke out upon his pallid face. If he complied with Mr. Haredale's last injunction now, it was because he had not the power to speak or move. He strained his gaze, and fixed it on a patch of moonlight, into which, if he continued to ascend, he must soon emerge. When he appeared there, he would try to call to him. Again the ashes slipped and crumbled. Some stones rolled down, and fell with a dull, heavy sound upon the ground below. He kept his eyes upon the piece of moonlight. The figure was coming on, for its shadow was already thrown upon the wall. Now it appeared, and now looked round at him. And now the horror-stricken clerk uttered a scream that pierced the air, and cried, "The ghost! The ghost!" Long before the echo of his cry had died away, another form rushed out into the light, flung itself upon the foremost one, knelt down upon its breast, and clutched its throat with both hands.
"Villain!"
cried Mr. Haredale, in a terrible voice, for it was he. "Dead and buried,
as all men suppose through your infernal arts, but reserved by heaven for this. At last I have you. You, whose hands are red with my brother's blood, and that of his faithful servant, shed to conceal your own atrocious guilt. You, Rudge, double murderer and monster, I arrest you in the name of God, who has delivered you into my hands. No, though you had the strength of 20 men, he added, as the murderer writhed and struggled, you could not escape me, or loosen my grasp tonight.
End of chapter 56.
Some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a huge inheritance. But a phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard for a new one on us. Just trade in any phone from our top brands with select unlimited plans. $829.99 purchase with new smartphone line on select unlimited plans. Minimum $90 per month with auto pay plus taxes and fees for 36 months required. Less $830 trade-in slash promo credit applied over 36 months. Trade-in terms apply. Payoff phone requires smartphone purchase and port-in with new smartphone line on select plan. Must provide most recent bill showing payoff amount of eligible phone. Additional terms apply.
This just in, hot off the bench press. Planet Fitness has added new strength equipment. Save $28 or more when you join today, and you can be one of the first to try it out. We're raising the bar with new benches, and our new hack squat will have you actually looking forward to leg day. Plus, we're still repping all of the best-in-class equipment we've always had, with most clubs open 24 hours, so you can work out your way on your time. So let's do this. Join Planet Fitness today and save $28 or more. Just $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 10th. See home club for details.